And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
Hello, and welcome to another live edition of the Metrospective Podcast, a special early week live show, because I'm Ted Berg. I'm joined, as usual, by one of the Athletic's Mets beat writers, Tim Britton, and now, for the first time, by the Athletic's new Mets beat writer, Will Salmon. Tim, hello.
Hey, Ted.
Will, welcome aboard.
Hey, Ted, thank you.
We're just to come in and join us on stage. We are speaking on, for those not joining us live, we're speaking on Tuesday in the early afternoon. The Mets won 4-1 over the Braves behind a great start from Max Scherzer on Monday night. Some firepower from Pete Alonso and a home run from Luis Guillorme, who's heating back up, which is nice to see. But I suspect a lot of our new listeners are interested to hear, a lot of our regular listeners are likely interested to hear from our new Mets beat writer, Will Salmon. Will, first of all, to get one concern some people had out of the way, are you squeezing Tim off of the Mets beat here?
I sure as heck hope not. that would not be, season, and I don't think that would be a fair trade. I just don't. I think you'd rather have some really thought-provoking literary quotes at the front of your articles, then just heading right into them with datelines and small paragraphs.
It is unfortunate for so many Mets fans that you are still stuck with me.
I don't think that's unfortunate. I think it's going to be great to have presumably nearly twice as much coverage, perhaps more in-depth coverage of the Mets, and maybe for me little more hopes that I can just ask you guys questions and you can go find out the answers. Specifically right now, what I'm wondering a lot about and have been wondering a lot about that I have not found much about online is Trevor Williams' Raven tattoo that takes up his entire forearm. If one of you guys wants to get on that would be very compelling content for me.
You know, that's probably something that's more up my alley, I would think.
Tim, have you not?
Because a targeted person.
Because Trevor Williams seems like an interesting dude. Tim mentions he's into reading sci-fi, and I've got to know about this. It's a very distinctive looking and sort of foreboding raven that takes up his whole arm. So I want to know what the deal is with that. I have lots of questions. We have some email questions that I wanted to crack into too. I'll start with one from Matt Anderson, who's presumably not the Matt Anderson who used to throw 106 mile an hour into the backstop for the Tigers. A different Matt Anderson, I assume. He wants to know, is this just anecdotal evidence I have incorrectly extrapolated, or does Seth Lugo's stuff, particularly his curve, seem diminished post-sticky stuff crackdown? Will, I would love to throw this to you, but I'm assuming Tim is better suited for this one.
Well, I would imagine so for obvious reasons of Seth Lugo not being a Brewers reliever for the last 3 months.
Right. You haven't looked all that up in the last day since you started. So I also have not looked up the spin rates on Lugo's curveball. I mean, the spin rates are still, believe they're still right up there elite among, if not the game's best, close to it.
They are exactly where they have been for most of his career. Even actually a touch better this year than they were in his best seasons in 2018 and 2019.
So I think, you know, if you're trying to time it to the sticky stuff crackdown last June, you're also timing it to like Seth Lugo's return from an offseason elbow surgery earlier in the year. You know, I think there's a couple different things that could be at work with him just not looking the way he did when he was pitching out of the bullpen in 2018, 2019, and the start of 2020. One is that they tried him in the rotation at the end of 2020, and you don't know what that does to a guy ramping up in season the way that Lugo had to. And the second is that offseason surgery, I think it was to remove bone spurs in his elbow. And we know that Lugo has the partially torn UCL that he's been pitching through for years, that, you know, he just doesn't seem quite as crisp and as consistently sharp as a reliever as he had prior to those events happening. And I think they probably have a larger part in causing that than anything with the sticky stuff. And yeah, also, I just want to say, I love the fact that like Matt Anderson came along at a time when like anyone who threw 100 miles an hour guaranteed that we would remember their name for the next quarter century. Now there's 15 guys in every organization who do that. Like, no one's going to be talking about Michel Otañez 25 years from now just because he threw 100. Like, he's going to have to do something else on top of that. But Matt Anderson, Joel Zamaya, we know these guys because of how hard they threw right off the bat.
I mean, Matt Anderson got work, like regular work with the Tigers, despite the fact that he was basically, like, had like a 1-to-1 strikeout to walk ratio. Like and I remember watching him like as a teenager and like the first time recognizing like the fear you must feel in the batter's box as an opposing hitter. Cause that guy he threw the ball so hard and had absolutely no idea where it's going. We have a question in the chat from John P who wants to know, it's more questions about Lugo. I would say with Lugo and Will, maybe this is more of a general statement, so maybe you do have insight onto this. I think that whatever you're seeing with Lugo is more likely confirmation bias than like an actual distinct specific difference between now and when he was a little bit better a few years ago. Like he just hasn't been as effective, and so it's not going to look as good. He's not going to feel as dominant when he comes into a game because he hasn't been quite as good. He hasn't been horrible. He's just like, you know, a guy looks a certain way when he is unhittable. I think it shows up in our heads and how we read them. And it also shows up in like how they walk around the mound and present themselves, because Lugo was a great reliever in 2018 and 2019. Now he is but a pretty good one.
Yeah, I think it's all relative to like what your expectations are and what they should be for somebody who's 32, 33 years old as a reliever who's been doing this for a few years. It's a historically volatile position, and this is a guy who is still pretty above average at the position. I mean, he does not have the, you know, numbers that he did, like you said, Ted, where he has like an ERA plus over 150. That those days are not there quite the same as they are now. But he's still above average, and he's still somebody that's helpful. He's not maybe the guy that you're putting in there in the eighth inning, and I'm not sure if they have somebody that you're putting in there in the eighth inning that makes you feel excited about these three outs are going to come quick and easy, and that they're going to be the perfect bridge to an outstanding closer. But I'm not sure if they necessarily need that just yet from him either, if they could acquire that at the deadline.
Yeah, I think that's right. Zach P is waiting to join us, but I will say to that point, like, you're right. Like, they don't have that guy for the eighth inning, but they also don't have this year like a Guillermo Mota guy where you're like, oh, absolutely no way do I want this guy in the game. Like every guy they're going to bring in there is okay. You know, they're all pretty good to good. There's no scrub. There's no guy who it's like, oh, I absolutely don't trust this guy in this spot. I don't want him nowhere near this. At times, different guys have felt that way. But if you look at the whole picture in the full season, bullpen's been good. I mean, we talk a lot about it, but it's a good bullpen. Zachary, what is going on?
Thanks for the Guillermo Mota PTSD tip.
I'm
appreciate
so sorry.
That.
I'm so sorry.
Will, welcome. I was at Citi Field for the first time this year, this past weekend, on Sunday when they lost. And, of course, as I always do there, it's always fun to hear the new walk-up music. I was particularly struck by Pete using Rush, Mark Canna using MIA, So, Will, the question is to you, and then, of course, to Ted and Tim. As a new beat writer here, Will, what would your walk-up music be? And part two of that question, who has the best walk-up music on the Mets?
Yeah, that's coming in hot. I probably will get into deep trouble with my girlfriend if I don't say Bad Bunny. So I'm probably going to go with like 25-8 from him. Willie Adames with the Brewers used that. It's excellent. With the Mets, I really like, you know, I haven't been to too many. So I grew up in Queens, had some family there. So I've been to Queens and I've stopped by some games here and there. And I was, of course, there for the Brewers series a few weeks ago, but I haven't been to too many to really have like a great idea on like who's the best one or who do I like the most. I'm really inclined to go with Guillorme though. I just love where that noise comes on, man. Something about it I know it's his at bat. It just stays with me. I like.
Well, it's his name repeated many times. It's great.
Yeah, it's the best. Yeah.
Do you have a choice though? You said Bad Bunny. Tim, I think we've talked about this before.
Well, first off, my goal is to get you, Ted, to start singing Carlos Beltran's old at bat music because I know you can. I forget if we talked about this because I break it into like what would be my at bat music versus what would be my reliever music.
Totally different thing. Yeah.
I feel better about the reliever choice, which is The Joker and the Thief by Wolfmother. And then I think for the at bat music, yeah, I haven't thought about this in a while, so it's my old pick, which is just Bad Company by Bad Company. Because I just like the idea of like the piano coming in at the start.
That is a terrible song, but go on.
I'm not saying the key to the at-bat music isn't that it's a good song. It's that it just has it catches you at the start. And then in terms of the Mets, the current roster, I think I like Canna's music the most. He's got MIA with Paper Planes most of the time. But he did. I thought it was very cool that on Pride Night he mixed it up and used a couple different LGBT related songs. You know, he had, I think, Born This Way by Lady Gaga for one of his at-bats. So I thought that was cool to just kind of mix it up on a theme night and respond that way with your at-bat music. I hadn't heard of a guy doing that before.
Did you notice that Joey Votto in the Red Series using the Dolly Parton song Jolene? I liked that.
Yeah, it was really disappointing. He only played the first game. Because I liked the Jolene for that, but then also, like, you know, you don't get to see Joey Votto play a lot. And that he's been out, I think, since that, really, that first game of that series. It was too bad that I know for Mets fans it was probably preferable to not have to face the best hitter the Reds have had in the last 40 years. But it would have been nice as a fan of baseball to watch him, like, face Max Scherzer on Tuesday night.
I think for me, like, the again, like you said, they're a totally different animal, closer music and at-bat music. For closer music, I've always said Dr. Dre's "Keep Their Heads Ringing" would be like a West Coast party jam that I think would be such a cool scene for coming into a game. The other thing as a closer that, and I know we've talked about this, Tim, I would also consider Complete Silence and getting the whole crowd on board. Like, everyone needs to know, like, everybody shut up. Ted Berg is coming in. He throws 107 and like he is lights out and everybody just be quiet. And the only thing you're going to hear in the stadium is the sound of like me grunting and my insanely fast pass with fastballs popping the glove. For a hitter, I think that like the song doesn't matter so much as it's like how recognizably yours it is, which is why I'm glad Will pointed out Guillorme's. So there's like I come across it all the time. Like, I'll come across like a section of a song where it's just like, this is cool. Like, there's an Ozo Motley song called Super Bowl Sunday. And like right in the middle, there's just this, like, this little breakdown part that I've always thought would be cool. Cause you wouldn't know the song. You would just know like, oh, that's this guy's at bat music. It involves a vibra slap which is like, it makes the noise. So I would use that. I think, the beginning of the Cake song "Love You Madly" is also like kind of a jam. One I would consider. These are like not things you can pull up off the top of your head, and so I apologize for that. And then the other thing is like just going with the total head scratcher one. Like, why can't we be friends or something like that? Just you know, or to go back to Dolly Parton, like the Dolly Parton, I Will Always Love You, just like something that's just so weepy and sad and not pump up oriented at all, just to like make the pitcher think about it a little bit. Brian L jumps in the chat to say James McCann's walk up music sucks. I don't know what it is. You gotta account for everybody having different tastes. I don't know what James McCann's is. I didn't know that Pete Alonso, I think he's used Rush in the past. I don't think he was using that earlier this season, at least not when I was at the game. Cause I would have picked that one out. Dean C is upset that I said that Bad Company is a bad song. I also think they'd probably be Bad Company. We have no one. If anyone wants to join us on stage, you're welcome to join the queue. No one in the queue right now, but Evan G wants to know, Mets fans are growing increasingly frustrated with JD Davis, of course John Smith as well. What are these two guys' values to the team if they show zero power? If they can't run into a home run once every 10 to 14 days, isn't it time to give Vientos a shot or look externally? It's not like these guys haven't had 4-plus seasons to prove themselves. Tim, what do you think about that?
Yes, July is the time to look externally if they're not hitting home runs or anything. You know, Dom Smith has gone almost a year without a home run. JD Davis has, I don't know how many on the season, not many. It's been, you know, outside of the Grand Slam the other day, it's been a while for him. For power, you know, you look at those two guys since the start of June, their OPS is something like 766, where it was before Monday, which is, you know, decent for a DH in this game. I think it'd be seventh best in baseball among DH production, where the idea of your DH being a guy who goes out, who rolls out of bed and has a 950 OPS like Travis Hafner or whatever, is not what it happens in Major League Baseball anymore. But it is clearly an area where the Mets can improve. And, you know, as the question says, like, if those guys aren't giving you a whole lot offensively, and it's not just home runs, but, you know, this offense can use home runs. You know, Davis doesn't have a lot of defensive value, obviously. Smith's defensive value is muted on this team because he plays the position that Alonso plays, it's just they don't fit the roster as well as they would on maybe some other teams. So I think, you know, we've talked about this is a spot where the Mets should be looking to upgrade. There's some different ways of doing that, whether it's the trade market or whether it's through their own system with Francisco Alvarez or Mark Vientos. Vientos, both of those guys are now in the futures game. Vientos was named as a replacement. I like the idea of Vientos in particular against left-handers because he's just mashed them his whole career and is really doing a number on them this year. I think last time I checked, it was like 7 homers in you know, 80 plate appearances against lefties or something. He's going to swing and miss a bit. He's going to strike out a lot. And the transition to the level might be difficult, but I think if you limit if you kind of give him a set role against left-handers, it has a better chance of being successful.
Yeah, it is currently nine home runs and 87 plate appearances against lefty, a 312, 368, 701 slash line. That's good. Will, have you formulated an opinion on Mark Vientos yet? Because you're going to need to.
Well, I will say, like, just to jump on like what Tim was saying with just what you're getting out of a DH these days, it's absolutely right. Like, there aren't too many guys like that. But I will say, though, that the slug that the Mets are getting from their DH position, I think it's something where around, like, 330. I think only last time I looked, I think it was just the Arizona Diamondbacks and the Oakland Athletics were worse. And that's not the type of company that a team like this should be in at any position, let alone the designated hitter. So absolutely, like, this is it's the time to address that. On Vientos, no, I have plenty of opinions on Alvarez. That's somebody that I wrote about. I spent a lot of time writing about Vientos, not as much. I just have not spent as much time having conversations about him. As far as the numbers go, he's the one, and Tim has written about this a bunch, that he's the person that, like, you would probably go with to try out first, just because, like, you probably feel better about just his readiness and just the steps that he's taken, just the gradual, like, he's been at AAA now, he's put up the numbers, so you kind of feel better just about not feeling like you're skipping a part at all with his development process.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you're as obsessed with basketball as I am, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Hey guys, this is JJ Redick. Twice a week, I'm cooking up something special for basketball junkies on my podcast, The Old Man and the Three. I bring on guests in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, like Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, or Paolo Banchero on his shooting workouts with Kevin Durant, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron when they were teammates in Miami. But it's not just about the player interviews. Every Monday, I break down the top three things happening around the NBA without the outlandish takes. Often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler, we dive deep into topics like rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is meme mugging now a tech? The Old Man and the Three is the only companion podcast you'll need during the playoffs this year. Be sure to listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
I have a question, a follow-up question for Will. You did that big Alvarez story on Monday. Like, what was the biggest thing that you learned about him during the process of that reporting? Because you talked to a whole bunch of people about him.
The joy factor really stuck out to me the most because I knew the guy could hit. I mean, that's pretty obvious, right? When you look at his numbers, it's not like I was watching too many of his minor league games before, say, the last month or so when I was plugged into a lot of at-bats recently where I would be streaming or just rewatching, frankly, just for that story's purpose and just to get a better idea of what the Mets have in their farm system, particularly at the top. And for me, like, the thing that, like, you would not see, of course, is that joy factor where the guy just really loves to be there. And I feel like that's one of those soft skills that people in baseball talk about that are not things that you can measure, that are not things that you could really put down without seeing him play. If you're a scout, like, you have to, like, watch him. And I'm not sure, like, how do you grade that and where do you put that? I don't know how much that matters in the grand scheme. I don't know. But I do think that part of his makeup will matter once he gets to New York because he has such high expectations placed on him that really in any other part of the country, like it wouldn't really matter as much. But for here in New York, you have to embrace that and you have to understand that comes with the territory here and that, like, you are looked at in a certain way and you get labels attached to you and you have to perform. And for him to be able to sort of embrace that, by all accounts, that's what really stood out to me over the course of the reporting, because that's what's going to help him get through some tough times, some inevitable tough times. And he's already had those, actually. Like, he has struggled at times. And the ability to bounce out of those in the biggest ways possible with these incredible hot streaks, that also was something that was striking to me because that just tells you that, yes, he's going to go through it like everybody else, but to be able to do it and to burst out of it in such a big way time and time again, like I said, it was pretty striking to see that pattern develop.
Well, he struggled a little bit in his first turn at AAA. It's very early, obviously, it's a tiny sample, but, like, I think if you talk to a lot of people in baseball, they'll say, like, that's a good thing for a prospect to have a couple bad weeks because you need to figure out what's going on and learn. Like, if you're just dominating every level and you never have a bad week, you're going to go to the majors and have a bad week and you have no skills for accommodating that. So, like, you know, obviously you'd rather Alvarez get up to Syracuse and immediately start mashing. But, you know, if you struggle for a week or two or a month, when you get to a new level, like, you do develop some skills in that.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting when I talked to Tim Hyers, who's the Rangers hitting coach, but was minor league hitting coordinator for the Red Sox back when they called up Xander Bogaerts during a pennant chase. And he knew, you know, he had been in the system when Andrew Benintendi and Rafael Devers were there, and they also kind of were called up in similar circumstances. And I asked him kind of like what you're looking for from a minor, you know, a minor league prospect in that situation that makes you feel comfortable in calling them up to the big leagues. And the first thing he said was they've got to have enough time to have gone through slumps. They've been able to go through rough patches and to get out of them, because you don't want the first big one to be on in a pennant race at the major league level, and they have no idea what to do and it snowballs on them, which is kind of what happened to Yoan Moncada when he was with the Red Sox, where he came up and struck out like 9 straight at bats and they just didn't play him anymore. So I thought that was interesting. And Will's point about Joy, like though I've only seen Alvarez play during a minor league season once, and that was in Brooklyn last summer. And that's what stood out to me was before the game, just the way he goes through like the team drills, the infield practice. Like he was the guy at second base taking throws when they're doing double play stuff. You know, there was an infectious energy about him. And you're not used to seeing like the best prospect be that guy. That's usually a guy who's an organization guy who's just kind of pulling through it. For Alvarez to be that guy, I thought was a really good sign.
DNC has been waiting for a while, and I'm just going to warn him that if he is coming on to defend bad company, he will have find very little patience from me. Dean, what is up?
Hey, what's going on, guys? Will, welcome. Thank you for coming on. Tim. Read your article yesterday about James McCann. But the thing is, I'm somewhat scrambling because I'm watching this Braves series with this team. And clearly the biggest weaknesses of the team, the Braves are very good at third base, Riley, DH, Ozuna is better than any DH they have. And then, of course, Darnell, who's better offensively than any catcher we have. And he was on the Mets and they gave him away for nothing. My question is like, how aggressive are they going to be at the trade deadline? Because the team has given up so many prospects over the years now. And even last year with, like, giving up Pete Crow, I look back at that trade and think that it's horrible. I don't know what you guys think of that. But, you know, so I was wondering how aggressive they're going to be. Thanks.
Yeah, I would not expect them. I wrote about the McCann situation and kind of likened it to Francisco Lindor last year where it, you know, with Lindor, that opened the door to trade for Javi Baez. They weren't thinking of adding a guy quite like Baez, but the appeal of him being able to play short until Lindor came back was really strong. And I thought maybe in this circumstance, the Mets would be looking mainly for a DH, but if that guy can catch until McCann comes back, that helps, and Wilson Contreras fits that bill. I think it's likelier that they trade for Contreras than it was before McCann got hurt. I still don't think it's likely because of what they gave up last year for Baez. Pete Crow Armstrong is also going to the Futures game. He's kind of gone from a fringe top 100 prospect last year when he was missing most of the season to now a guy who's a pretty solid top 100, maybe even top 50 prospect in the game. And they've just, you know, the Mets, they live in a world where they've made all of these trades by now, and the Crow Armstrong is another one on top of that. So it's difficult for them to pull that trigger again for a rental and for a guy who you really have no interest in signing long term. You could have talked yourself into going after Baez in the offseason, and the Mets did to an extent. But Contreras, you're not going to do that because you've got Alvarez coming up. You've got McCann under contract. You've got Nito as a reasonable backup in your organization already. So I don't think Contreras is the guy they're going to spend a lot of prospect capital on. I think, you know, maybe a different DH. And because, again, the need is DH, like you can go into various different positions on the field, whether it's a first baseman like Josh Bell, whether it's an outfielder like Andrew Benintendi, for instance. He doesn't really solve the power issue. And I think there's probably more, there's a wider range of options. Like if you want a catcher, it's Contreras. Or it's maybe Sean Murphy from Oakland, and Murphy might cost even more than Contreras because of the team control, which, again, not valuable to the Mets. So I think there's a wider range of guys you can go after at DH that would improve this team, improve this roster, improve the lineup. So I think that's probably where they spend some capital. And then, again, in the bullpen, you know, whether it's one guy. Have we, Ted, ever talked about Andrew Chafin on this? Because that's a guy that's kind of piqued my interest of late. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's a left-handed reliever. But I think he might be a fit for this team. I think, you know, most objective observers will say that the 1999 National League Championship Series was the greatest baseball series ever played. up until the bottom of the 11th inning of game six.
Do you remember the 1999 NLCS? You grew up in the area. Are you old enough to remember that?
I am. No, I am definitely
good.
Old enough.
Okay, good.
Yeah, actually, like, The Athletic posted a tweet saying that, like, once upon a time, there was a young writer. And just for the record, I will want to say that I am still relatively young, Ted. So I do have a bone to pick with The Athletic for that. But I do remember the 99 playoff run. That was great. It was a great time up until it ended for the Mets, of course. But yeah, you know, you said something, Ted, very interesting, because I was actually having a conversation with somebody before we recorded about just the differences between the team that I covered in the Brewers and now covering the Mets, and there are some major differences there. But one thing that the person pointed out was the Dodgers and how they can still spend money but yet have a good farm system or a great farm system, one with depth. And that was something that we were talking about, too, because I have been looking at box scores pretty much every day for the past month or so in preparing for this job across the Mets farm system. And what I noticed is that these guys, not a lot of guys have great numbers. Like, and if you look at some other teams, it's up and down the list of guys who, like, you've never heard of, that maybe they're just depth or organizational guys, or maybe they're people who are flamethrowers in AA, but they have, like, these, like, high strikeout rates. They have things that just make your eyes or your eyebrows rise, and the Mets just don't. And so I'm with you on that point. I think it's a very smart take. And just one thing on, like, the catcher DH situation, I think Tim was right with what he said about Oakland's catcher, with that's going to require a haul as well. And, like, you get into that weird situation where you have McCann under contract still, and you also have Alvarez coming up through the minors. You know, one guy who was kind of interesting to me, just maybe this is just bias based on the team that I was covering, but, you know, Pedro Severino comes to my mind as somebody who could be expendable from their side of things, just because they have three catchers now that they're carrying. And yes, he's not great defensively, but he does have some power. And so I wonder if he could be a stopgap option, if at all, for the next few weeks for the Mets, if that is somebody that is of interest. But overall, the catcher market is just, it's kind of Contreras or bust. And like Tim suggested, it's just, I'm not sure if that's, you know, the long-term answer for you to give up the farm for that, or to give up what you had in the farm for that after making the trades that you made last year.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and as Tim has pointed out a few times, and I think Sadov and Patrick Mooney at The Athletic wrote about the trade deadline from the Cubs' perspective and mentioned it as well. It's like, it's kind of hard when you have a veteran, especially a pitching staff like the Mets. I mean, maybe it makes it actually a little easier in a catcher if it's Max Scherzer and he knows what he's doing, but it's always hard to switch your regular catcher mid-flight. And what they do have in Nito and McCann is really, really good defense. Like, and I'm not sure the extent to which that mitigates their complete lack of offensive production. But Nito has just been, I mean, he won the game for them defensively a few nights ago by backpicking John Birdie off second base. And he's just been incredible defensively. Like, very, I really enjoy watching him. And McCann has this, you know, incredible reputation for how well he handles the pitching staff. He's got a fine arm. He's a good framer as well. I don't know. I think that, like, a guy like, if for McCann's absence, I would say, like, yeah, a guy like Severino, someone like sort of a stopgap part-time player makes a lot of sense. It seems unlikely to me that they would try to swing a huge deal for a guy like Contreras when they're in the situation that they're in, where it's not like Javi Baez, where there's this possibility where, oh, there's a long-term fit here. You know, Contreras would not be a long-term fit. It would be a pure rental. I feel like the easier way to operate the offense, the much easier way, it's going to be cheaper in terms of prospect capital, and also a significant upgrade, would be what we talked about, which would be finding a DH, a guy who can play every day, or most days, you know, either, you know, first base filling in for Alonso, or a corner outfield, and most of the time in that designated hitter spot, because they just haven't gotten a lot from that position, and it's one where you should be able to fill it pretty easily. I have a question for you, Will, which is that I read you were a nighttime security guard at Citi Field.
I sure was. Yes, I can confirm that that's true. Yes.
Oh, how was it? Because I was a vendor at Shea, so we have that in common. And then we were trying to get into the game to get paid to get into the Met Stadium. But did you get to see any games, or is it just purely overnight?
No, so I worked mostly games actually when I was 18. Yeah, when I was 18 or 19 years old, it was a great job. So my best friend, his father, it's actually a unionized thing over there. I'm not sure people know that or care, but long story short, my best friend's father is in it, has been in for a long time. When I was 18 or so, I needed a job, did that. And yeah, what's better than when you're that age or a little bit older, a little bit younger, whatever, to get into the game for free and to get paid for it, to stand around. I guess that was a great job. I just stood around and I watched the game. Now I sit around and watch the game and get paid, but I actually have to write too, so it's not the same in that sense. But yeah, still getting paid to just stare into the field, just in a different way.
Yeah, I as a vendor, I also stood around watching the game a lot. That is not really what they're looking for out of their vendors.
you know, what they're looking for their security guards either, but. Hey, I mean, are you actually going to do the job of a security officer at Citi Field? Maybe if there's a fight or two, but that happens when there's like Phillies and Yankees games. But beyond that, it's pretty chill.
What was worse than at least this is my experience, and it was only one summer I vended, but it was never more fraught than and that was when the Subway Series was still like a relatively new phenomenon, and the, you know, 25,000 Yankee fans descending on a sold out Shea Stadium made for a nightmarish day as a vendor.
Yeah, no, for me, it was the Phillies games actually, because those would get like just, I mean, like they were like, there was some serious fist fights in those, and they still are, I'm sure, but. I mean, I remember like separating people, having like people's blood on my shirt. It was just nasty and gross.
Yikes.
Yeah, it wasn't the best. So those for me were like the most, those are the memories that stand out as far as, yeah, I don't want to revisit that anytime soon.
It's better probably what you're doing now, sitting in the, although I would say, now you've spent some time in the Citi Field press box. To me, it's like a little bit airport loungy. Like I could go for throwing the windows open a few more times, but it's probably a lot more comfortable than standing between a drunk Phillies fan and a drunk Mets fan.
Slightly, yes.
I wonder if we have Tim Britton back. Tim, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
I can.
Did you hear? I just finished my exposition on the 99 NLCS. You guys got all that, right?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, good.
It
good,
ended
glad.
Poorly.
No, I did want to make one point. You guys talking about the catcher position. You know, you look at teams that have been really good the last couple of years. Like the 2018 Red Sox had basically nothing offensively from their catchers. That was Sandy Leon and Christian Vasquez and a little bit of Blake Swihart. And had like a 530 OPS from their catchers over the course of the entire season. They won 108 games in the World Series. The Astros have been to the World Series three times in the last 5 years. Most of that time, Martin Maldonado has been their catcher. Again, not a guy who's given you much offensively. So I think really, like you guys said, it's what happens around that position in the lineup. The Mets have the really good defensive tandem between McCann and Nito. Someone in the chat pointing out that I pointed out that the catcher ERA difference is relatively eye-opening. It's a stat I don't love leaning on too much, but every starter has been better with McCann versus Nito. And part of that could be the timing of it, that, you know, McCann was catching primarily in April when maybe the weather was colder and hitters
were
not up to
speed. Went on that incredible run in April. Like, I don't think you can credit McCann with that, right? That was just like one of those things. The Mets starters were pitching unbelievable. It didn't matter who was back there.
Right, but he's also a guy who, like you said, Ted, has a long reputation of developing really good rapports with his starting pitchers. And so, I think the Mets can get away with what they have at catcher as long as they supplement elsewhere on the roster, specifically at designated hitter.
Well, I am excited that we have supplemented our coverage roster here. Will, Thank you for joining us. I imagine we'll be speaking more in the coming weeks and months.
Oh, definitely. Well put, Ted. Happy to supplement the coverage along with Tim. I think we should provide Mets readers of The Athletic with great content for what should be a very, very compelling rest of the summer.
We will be back with more great podcast content, as always, later in the week. Until then, Will, Tim, peace out.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.